Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 19th of April, these are our main stories. Tensions rise yet again between Israel and Tehran as explosions are reported at an Iranian military base. Ukraine says it has for the first time shot down one of the Russian strategic bombers that have been tormenting its cities. The top four runners in Beijing's half marathon have been stripped of their prizes after a race that saw athletes from Africa let a Chinese competitor win. Also in this podcast, we hear about efforts to reunite families decades after the civil war in El Salvador.
La fractura familiar.
The continuous separation of families becomes a fracture in society. If people don't have their own peace, then society as a whole cannot achieve peace.
Following an apparent airstrike near a military base in Iran early on Friday, world leaders are calling for restraint. It seems that the attack on the central province of Isfahan was the response Tehran was expecting after its major missile and drone attack on Israel at the weekend. US officials have said that Israel was responsible for today's explosions near a military base, although Israel itself hasn't given official confirmation. At a meeting of the G7 in Capri, Italy's foreign minister was asked whether the US knew about the reported Israeli strike on Iran. Antonio Tajani said the US government was informed at the very last minute by Israel about the attack and states there was no involvement from Washington. Antonio Tajani said the goal was now ensuring the situation doesn't escalate further.
Io ho voluto subito che ci fosse un messaggio chiaro.
I wanted a very clear message to come out from the whole of the G7. The political goal of the G7 is de-escalation. We invite all parties to work to avoid any escalation.
After a news conference at the same G7 meeting, the UN Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was asked whether Washington was given advance warning that Israel was launching an attack on Iran.
I'm not going to speak to that, except to say that the United States has not been involved in any offensive operations. What we're focused on, what the G7 is focused on, is our work to de-escalate tensions, to de-escalate from any potential conflict. You saw Israel on the receiving end of an unprecedented attack, but our focus has been on, of course, making sure that Israel can effectively defend itself, but also de-escalating tensions, avoiding conflict, and that remains our focus.
I asked Majid Afshar from the BBC Persian service what we know about today's attacks.
We don't know exactly what the extent was, but loud explosions were heard in the cities of Tabriz and Isfahan in early hours of this morning. At 4 o'clock in the morning, people said they could hear the air defense system near Isfahan, which is close to the international airport as well, has been activated. And later on, this was confirmed by official reports that the loud explosions was the result of the activation of the air defense system. They said that they had downed 3 drones, as they say, small drones. And later on, they denied there was any sound of explosion in Tabriz. But now the governor has confirmed that the air defense system was activated in Tabriz in northwest of the country as well. These are the main two cities where the main air defense systems, along with Hamadan and Tehran, are located.
Now, the concern around the world really has been that an escalation could be caused by this tit-for-tat, if you like, between the two countries. What's been the official reaction?
The facts and the effort by the Iranian media and by the Iranian military officials so far to downplay the incident tells us that they are trying to somehow convince the public that this was a failure and there was no attack. A senior official has now told a number of news agencies that this was not an attack. Even if it was something, it was an infiltration. So there is no plan for retaliation. We know that both sides were trying to restore deterrence. So by downplaying this incident, maybe they can achieve that goal.
It's strange, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you're saying that, but also Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, within the last couple of days, said he vowed that the tiniest invasion by Israel would bring a massive and harsh response. I suppose perhaps saying one thing to the local population and from what you're saying, other people are saying other things for the international community.
That's in one way correct. But at the same time, you know, there have been a lot of talks, private channels between the Americans, Iranians and through mediators on how this attack could look like over the past couple of days. There have been considerations. And I think with what has happened now, and if we agree with the fact that this was an airstrike, and based on what the Israeli officials have told Washington Post, this was a message to the Iranians, and the Iranians seem to have received the message.
Majid Afshar from the BBC Persian Service. So what's the reaction been in Israel? Yulan Nell, our correspondent in Jerusalem, gave us this update.
First of all, we don't have official confirmation from the Israeli military of any offensive in Iran, but Israeli media are reporting this as an Israeli strike. US media quoting Israeli and US officials confirming that, and that's been widely picked up on here. One reported quote was saying that the aim was to signal to Iran that Israel does have this capability to strike in the heart of the country. This is a central province, Isfahan, of course. There are reports of explosions near to this key military base, and it's already been remarked on that if Israel wanted to respond like for like to what happened with the unprecedented Iranian direct attack last weekend, it could go for military bases, because really with 99% of the drones and missiles intercepted and downed, the only few really that got through that we know about, some of those hit the Nevatim air base, a sensitive Israeli military site in the southern Negev desert. And of course, Isfahan, by hitting there, Israel is saying that it can get close to the nuclear facilities that are located in that province. The key one, the Natanz uranium enrichment plant. Although we've had Iran making clear, the International Atomic Energy Agency making clear that these nuclear sites were not affected, it still sends a message.
Yulan Nell in Jerusalem. Our international editor Jeremy Bowen gave us his assessment of how Western leaders' calls for de-escalation are being received in the Middle East.
Well, everyone's calling for restraint, actually, about this pretty much, except for, no doubt, hardliners in Iran. And there are a few hardliners in Israel as well. Itamar Ben-Gvir, the security minister, national security minister in Israel, who said after the initial last Saturday, the Iranian response to that Israeli airstrike, he said then that Israel should go berserk, and his one word tweet this morning was feeble or useless, something like that. That is the translation of the Hebrew. And so, you know, as well as there are more serious characters too inside the Israeli war cabinet, there are retired generals, Messrs. Gantz and Eisenkot, who wanted to have a fierce response pretty quickly to all of this, because for the Israelis, showing that they are able to deter their enemies is enough for them. Biden and others have been trying to persuade them that they have effectively deterred them by dealing with that large Iranian attack, albeit with the help of powerful Western allies, notably the United States. And so I think that if Israel doesn't lob any more missiles in the direction of Iran, then I think that this probably will draw a line under the epicenter, or the fact that the Middle East is still in absolute turmoil.
Jeremy Bowen. A few weeks after the death of the Russian opposition leader and chief Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, one of his closest aides was repeatedly attacked with a hammer near his home in exile. Leonid Volkov, who was Alexei Navalny's chief of staff, lives in Lithuania. Now, two people have been arrested in Poland on suspicion of carrying out that attack. For more, we spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
The attack happened on the 12th of March in Vilnius. So some people had broke the window of Leonid Volkov's car, and they sprayed him with tear gas, and then they beat him with a hammer. He was badly wounded on the leg, but it wasn't broken. but his arm was broken in that attack, and he's also got bruising to the face. And this all happened, of course, just days before the presidential election in Russia. He called it a gangster greeting from President Putin.
Now, this man, or these men rather, have been arrested in Poland. What are people saying in Lithuania about this?
Well, the arrests were initially announced by the Lithuanian president, Gitanas Nausėda, and it's a clear important development for Lithuania, given that the attack happened on its soil. One of the things that Mr. Nausėda said was he told the organisers it was a warning from Lithuania and Poland not to repeat such attacks. He didn't blame President Putin, but the Lithuanian intelligence services have said that that is the line of thinking.
Meanwhile, Mr. Volkov, what's he been saying about this and who he believes was responsible for the attack?
He has thanked the security services in both Poland and Lithuania. And he said it's important to investigate and expose what he called the chain of command there. So that's right from the man who hit him with a hammer all the way up, as I said, to President Putin, who he blames for the attack. So the Kremlin, of course, would dismiss such allegations. But the Leonid Volkov, as Alexei Navalny's chief of staff, is a constant and persistent thorn in their side. In the election itself, the Russian presidential election, you could see a video of a live broadcast of Mr. Volkov with his arm in a sling. So he went straight back to work and was trying to encourage people to turn out for a noon protest in memory of Alexei Navalny during that presidential election.
Danny Eberhard. Ukraine's military says it shot down a long-range Russian strategic bomber used to fire cruise missiles against it. Moscow said a bomber had crashed in southern Russia after a combat mission. James Waterhouse is in the Ukrainian capital.
Kyiv says the Tupolev bomber was on its way back from dropping missiles on Ukraine. Footage online appears to show the aircraft falling from the sky with its distinctive wide wingspan visible. Ukrainian officials say the bomber's downing was part of a special operation between the country's air force and intelligence service. For Ukraine, it was a night when Russia reportedly launched 22 missiles and 14 drones.
Voting is underway in elections in India, the world's largest democracy, where almost 1 billion people are eligible to cast their vote. Because of India's vast size, voting is split into 7 phases spread over the next 6 weeks. Our South Asia correspondent, Samira Hussain, who's in New Delhi, told us more.
It is absolutely massive. We're talking about almost 970 million eligible voters. So voting actually has to take place in 7 phases over the next 6 weeks. And so just today, there are 166 million eligible voters. That is the combined populations of France and the UK and then some. So I think that just gives you the sense of the scale. And what they've done is that they have there is voting taking place in 21 different states across the country. And part of the reason what makes voting here just such a big monumental task is not only the size of the population, but it's also the size of the country and the diversity within the country. And because according to Indian law, you cannot be more than 2 kilometers away from a polling booth. So you're in a situation in which you have electoral officials that are traveling 5 hours, sometimes on animals, to be able to take a voting machine to one resident, perhaps in a remote area in a forest.
Samira Hussain. Still to come in this podcast, Taylor Swift has surprised fans by releasing a secret double album with 15 new songs laden with references to her love life.
There's basically a Taylor Swift industrial complex at this point. There will be thousands of articles published today working out what the songs are about.
Every few years, the El Niño weather phenomenon brings dramatic change to weather in many parts of the world. The most recent occurrence of this has caused problems across the Pacific region and beyond. After months of disrupted weather, a few days ago, Australia announced that the El Niño weather event has now ended, whilst in India, it's weakened to what it called a neutral stage. But what exactly is El Niño? Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath explains.
So El Niño is a naturally occurring climate phenomenon that sees warm water come to the surface of the Pacific Ocean, the Eastern Pacific Ocean, every 2 to 7 years. It's been going on for decades, probably centuries. And what that does is it sets off a chain reaction around the world. It brings heat to the surface. It makes the whole world a bit warmer. It changes the nature of the winds that blow around the world as well. So it changes the nature of the weather that people get. So it makes storms in the Pacific more likely. It makes storms in the Atlantic less likely. It sees the southern United States become wetter, the northern part become drier. In Africa, though, it has possibly its most powerful impact. So countries like Kenya and Tanzania often see much wetter weather during an El Niño phase, and countries in the southern part of Africa, everywhere from Angola, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Botswana, Mozambique, they all see much drier weather, and that can have significant impacts on food production. That's what we've been seeing this year. And El Niño runs for about 9 months to a year. It peaked in December, but the scientists say it's 2 or 3 months after that that you get the full effects of it and it starts to fade. So in recent days, scientists have said El Niño has ended, but we're still feeling those effects. And in the last couple of months, particularly in southern Africa, the drought there has been clearly linked to this powerful El Niño.
One of the areas which has been badly affected by El Niño is the Philippines, where the beginning of the warm, dry season has coincided with the tail end of the climate phenomenon. Rina Gilani is the UN Climate Crisis Coordinator for the El Niño response, and she told Davina Gupta how the country had been affected.
I'm here in the Philippines, and, you know, here they 50% of the Philippine land has been affected by drought and the crops have failed. So we have about 1.4 million people affected right now by the drought. And it's sort of the El Niño peak is ending, but the impact is going to last a lot longer. I mean, people haven't been able to grow food, so there isn't food on the table and there isn't anything to sell to earn money. And this will be felt throughout the year.
And how does this feed into the global food supply cycle?
There's a problem, actually, in many parts of the world. So because of the impact of El Niño, actually, in the drought. So in southern Africa, it has also been harshly hit. You're actually seeing governments that used to provide food to other parts of the world, including in that region, now having to say, we don't have enough for ourselves. We're going to have to hold it back. And not only that, find food from elsewhere. We're seeing prices of rice actually go up. I think there's an increase of about 39% because of this issue in Asia as well.
Then how much difficult does it become for an agency like the United Nations to ensure that food, for example, is provided to the poorest of the poor if you're looking at the prices go up and the impact of it on especially the regions which are undergoing drought and severe food crisis?
Many of the governments, I mean, the good news is that we now have much more better way of predicting that this is coming. So many governments have actually prepared ahead of time and kept reserves of food. But there are the most vulnerable that we need to support and help feed. So we do source food from elsewhere, but the costs are going up. And as you know, we've had this problem on the cost of fuel even as well, which impacts our ability to move it around. And of course, many, many communities are talking about the fact that they are now eating, you know, less than the three meals a day that they used to.
Rina Gilani. And now to El Salvador, where a woman has been reunited with her relatives almost 40 years after being sent to the US for adoption during her country's civil war. Flor Wollman only learnt last year that she had living relatives back in Central America and that they'd been searching for her. Although the war between left-wing guerrillas and a US-backed army ended in 1992, efforts continue to reunite hundreds of families separated during the fighting, as Mike Lanchin now reports.
Welcome, sister.
Thank you.
We love you.
Joy and happiness in a remote village in northern El Salvador as Flor Wollman meets three siblings she never knew existed.
I don't want to cry.
Tears and hugs from the 42-year-old Flor and her two half-brothers and a half-sister as neighbours and well-wishers look on. We looked for you for years, oldest brother Marlon tells Flor, but then we found out that you were looking for us.
I'm here now, that's all that matters. Okay.
Flor has spent almost all her life in the US after being adopted from El Salvador by an American couple. That was in 1984, at the height of the civil war between left-wing rebels and the US-backed army. Flor was five at the time. She still remembers the terror of fleeing government soldiers near her home.
I just remember they were saying, run, they're here. And I kept on running, and I ended up seeing a little shack. I didn't know what else to do, so I kind of just ran in there, and eventually the door opened, and there was a soldier there with a big rifle, and he didn't say anything. He just shot me.
Luckily, little Flor survived. The next thing she recalls is waking up in a strange house in the capital, the home of her new foster parents. No one explained why she was there. This is Margarita Zamora, lead investigator for a Salvadorian organization called Asociación Pro Búsqueda. Since the war ended in 1992, the group has been trying to trace children who were separated from their families during the conflict. So far, 400 have been located, many of them abroad.
Many of the children who were taken from the battlefield were given away in adoption. Many appeared as if their parents had given their consent, but the parents were in fact killed. There was no consent given.
Margarita says that there are many more children who must now be adults, still unaccounted for. Sunday Mass in a tall white brick church that dominates the simple square of this village. Many of the missing children were from areas like these where the rebels had hideouts in the surrounding hills. Even now, more than 30 years after the war ended, families still hold out hope. Father Manuel Acosta is a priest from the area and until recently was part of a government commission looking into such cases.
The continuous separation of families becomes a fracture in society. I think that if people don't have their own peace, and peace for their families, then society as a whole cannot achieve peace, and conflict and divisions just continue.
Growing up with her adoptive American parents, Flor always wondered whether anyone was searching for her back in El Salvador.
I just always wanted to know why I wasn't with my biological parents when I was running. Why was I separated?
Flor's search for information eventually led her to Margarita Zamora and the Pro Búsqueda Asociación in San Salvador. Last year, they got back to her to say that although her birth parents were no longer alive, they had located surviving relatives.
In life, it's just a total different feeling.
So do you still think of yourself as one of El Salvador's missing children?
Yes, but not anymore. I'm not missing anymore.
That was Flor Woolman ending that report from Mike Lenchen. And you can hear more about the story of El Salvador's missing children on the documentary. Just search online for BBC World Service, the documentary. To China next, where the authorities are dealing with an athletics scandal. The first four runners in this year's Beijing men's half marathon have been stripped of their results and their prize money. It comes after footage showed three of the runners appear to let a Chinese athlete cross the finishing line first. I spoke to our China correspondent, Stephen McDonnell.
These three African runners coming towards the finish line, I suppose a couple of hundred metres out, just behind them, the Chinese champion He Jie. Now, one of the Africans can be seen indicating to He Jie to go past them. He does this. It's all very clear. This is what's going on. And he crosses the line first. This led to an outcry on social media here from Chinese sports fans. Now, on the one hand, you might think they'd be happy to see a Chinese runner win the Beijing half marathon, but not in these circumstances. They felt that it was a sham and there was a lot of complaints. And as a result, an investigation from the organisers of the race and also China's sporting have come up with is the decision to strip the runners of their medals, to strip them of their prize money and their final placings. And one of the key problems also, I mean, apart from the fact that they let He Jie cross before them, is that the Africans from Kenya and Ethiopia were actually pacers in the race. So that's the people who are not real participants. They join the race to go out hard and drag everyone else along to make it a sort of faster result. Well, they weren't properly identified as pace runners, and so to the casual viewer, they might think, well, there goes He Jie, he's just charging past these African runners when they were not actually fully-fledged participants in the marathon anyway.
So given that, it seems perhaps some people might think it's a little bit unfair on them, and indeed on Hergé as well. What have the runners been saying about their actions?
Well, the decision's only just been announced, so we haven't heard from them yet. But, like, initially, I mean, they weren't trying to hide it. Like, for example, the Kenyan runner, William Nangat, the day after the race, he was interviewed by the BBC, and he said, yeah, I let Hergé win because he's my friend. So they were very open about the fact that they were doing this. And in one way, it sort of looked, I guess, like a kind of sportsmanship type thing. You know, you're the local hero, we'll let you win. But, you know, people who organise these races, they want them to be serious. It's not any old race. It's the Beijing Half Marathon. It's not the main marathon here, but still it's an important race. And to have it finish in such a kind of, well, seemingly dodgy fashion has not gone down well with China's sports fans, and nor has it gone down well with the officials here who've been very critical of how the whole matter was handled.
Stephen McDonnell. Doctors in Japan are not at all happy with Google Maps, and more specifically, the reviews left on Google Maps about them. And so they've taken action. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me more.
63 doctors in Japan have gathered together to launch what's being described as a landmark lawsuit against Google Maps. They say that's because they feel like punching bags, they say, because when a patient goes on and leaves a negative review for a medical clinic on Google Maps, the doctors themselves have no way to answer back to these reviews because of patient confidentiality. And the doctors go on to say that unlike a regular business that's reviewed on Google Maps, like a coffee shop or a manicure place, if a negative review is left, it's because they didn't live up to customer service. The business didn't go far enough to please a customer. But doctors say they're not like that. They're tasked with treating their patients' health within certain guidelines. So they don't want to feel additional pressure to refuse patients possible requests for medication or extra tests just to satisfy their reviews that might turn up on Google Maps. And so that's why they've gone to the platform to say you need to do a better job of taking down these negative reviews.
And briefly, they're worried because Google Maps is pretty influential.
Yeah, that's right. So Google Maps, it's described by the lawyers as being essential infrastructure in Japan. And that's true. Google Maps is incredibly detailed in Japan. Almost every business has a lot of reviews, and that includes medical clinics, much to the doctor's disgust.
Celia Hatton. She is the world's biggest pop star. Some might even say she is the music industry. Taylor Swift has surprised her fans by releasing what she described as a secret double album version of her new record. Stephanie Zacherson reports. The crowd was chanting more. I was grinning like I'm winning. I was hitting my
marks. 'Cause I can do it with a broken heart. When Taylor Swift releases new music, she does it with a bang. Her latest album, called The Tortured Poets Department, had already made Spotify history by becoming the most pre-saved album ever on the streaming service. And as a lover of Easter eggs and surprises, overnight she revealed it's a double album of 31 tracks, 2 hours and 2 minutes. That makes it the longest album yet from the multi-Grammy Award winner, whose global Eras tour is having such an economic impact that it's actually improving the GDP of the countries where she performs on stage. Laura Snapes is The Guardian's deputy music editor.
There's basically a Taylor Swift industrial complex at this point. There will be thousands of articles published today working out what the songs are about. And we're less than a month away of the tour coming to Europe when I assume that she's going to revamp the Eras tour with a new bit dedicated to this album. So fans who have seen the concert film of the Eras tour on Disney Plus or in the cinema will get something new. You'll be further incentivized to go again. And then I suspect that will be put out in cinemas too.
So what are reviewers making of the new record? Rolling Stones labelled it Swift's most personal album yet. The Los Angeles Times writes that it emanates a proudly villainous energy, and Billboard called it a wildly unguarded breakup album.
The so-called Swifties, the pop star's fans, have been gathering for listening parties across the world, staying up late or getting up early to have a first listen to the new tunes. Izzy Pearson and Isabel Butterworth are president and founders of the Taylor Swift Society at the University of Sheffield in the UK.
She's not really telling the full story, so it's really easy to relate it to your life. And her songs have grown with her as she's gone on. As we see in this new album, we had Lover because she was in love. And now we have the Tortured Poets Department because that love didn't last. And I think people can relate to being in that situation. And for a fortnight there, we were
forever running to you sometimes. Taylor Swift's new single, Fortnight, ending that report by Stephanie Zacharyson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. But before we go, here's a message from Valerie Sanderson about this week's Happy Pod.
In this edition, we meet the teenager whose Dancing in the Rain in Nigeria brought viral fame that's inspired a documentary about him. We'll hear about the football coach who started a team and a school for refugee children, the Mongolian yak herders helping to make fashion sustainable, Fatu in Germany turns 67, she's a gorilla by the way, and how a four-legged tour guide is keeping visitors on the right track. That's all in the Happy Pod, available from Saturday, the 20th of April.
And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Vladimir Muzetschka and the producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.